I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
My name is Jim Obergefell, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I've lived in Ohio for most of my life. My late husband, John, and I were together for almost 21 years before he passed away as a result of the complications of ALS. I'm here today in front of our nation's highest court because my home state fought the recognition of my marriage to John. And when the man I loved and cared for passed away from one of the cruelest diseases known to humanity, the state of Ohio, the state in which I've lived, worked, and paid taxes for most of my life, continued to fight my right to list my name on John's death certificate. No American should have to suffer that indignity. That's why John and I and the 30 plaintiffs who are part of this lawsuit decided to fight. I know in my heart that John is with me today. That man cared for and loved me for 21 years through thick and thin. Today's ruling from the Supreme Court affirms what millions across this country already know to be true in our hearts. Our love is equal.
That's our guest, Jim Obergefell, speaking on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court last June after the court affirmed the constitutional right of gay couples to marry. The landmark case of Obergefell v. Hodges was a 5-4 decision. Writing for the majority, Justice Kennedy spoke of the transcendent importance of marriage for all people, and he made the link between marriage and liberty. So how did a self-described reluctant activist end up being the lead plaintiff in this historic case? Our guest, Jim Obergefell. I'm going to just do it the way I practice it. Jim Obergefell and Debbie Senzipper have co-authored a book that answers that question, Love Wins, the lovers and lawyers who fought the landmark case for marriage equality. And Jim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. And Debbie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
So what did you think when you filed the suit? This was a couple of years ago in Ohio, Jim, that you would be standing on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Never in my wildest dreams. But I have to be honest, when John and I decided to file the suit, when we decided to fight, for me, I wasn't thinking about the future. I wasn't thinking outside of our marriage. If I thought about the future, that meant thinking about John's death. You know, my high school government class rattled around in the back of my head, so that thought was there. We're filing in federal court. This could end up in the Supreme Court. But I can't say I ever honestly thought about it.
In the beginning, it was really to get your name on his death certificate.
Correct.
That was really the goal.
Absolutely. That was what we wanted. We wanted that respect. We wanted that dignity.
Why did you get involved in this story, Debbie, if I can put it that way?
Well, I was working. I've worked for 25 years and as an investigative reporter at major newspapers, most recently at the Washington Post. And I've been looking, wanting to write a book for a long time. And I had a loose family connection to John and to Jim and his late husband, John. And I was just moved by the story. I was drawn to it and I knew I wanted to tell it. And Jim, was wonderful enough to let me tell the story. So I took an immediate leave of absence from the Washington Post. Even before the Supreme Court ruled, not knowing which way they would go, I just knew that there was a story here to tell, and I wanted to do it.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. You grew up, you were born, grew up in Ohio.
Correct. Born and raised in Ohio. And
Catholic family.
Baby of six in a Catholic family, yes. And, you know, growing up, for me, looking at my family, looking at the world I was in, the only possible future I saw was marrying a woman and having children. That was just what you did as the baby of a family of six in a Catholic family. So that's what I expected. And I knew at a young age that I was different. We all do. Those of us in the LGBTQ community, we know that. And it took going to graduate school and finding myself in an environment that didn't just tolerate differences, it celebrated and accepted them, that I finally had the courage to come out.
Well, you came out to various members of your family, to your father, to your mother, to your sister. What was the kind of response that you got?
Right. I came out to my father first, and I feel really fortunate to say this, and I know I'm lucky. When I told my dad, his only response or his immediate response was, well, Jim, all I've ever wanted is for you to be happy.
Did that surprise you that that was his response? Because he sounds like a guy with a little bit of a temper.
Well, I think he had a little bit of a temper, but not that was ever directed towards me. verbally, physically, in any way, and I'm pretty certain my siblings can say the same thing. Was I surprised? No, I don't think I was, because my mom had passed away 9 years earlier, 8 or 9 years earlier, and my dad and I had had a chance to actually develop a much stronger, a much closer relationship because of that. So was I surprised? No. Was I thrilled? Absolutely, yeah. Because that's what every gay kid wants to happen. My siblings were fantastic, and I think my favorite story is I called my sister, she's the oldest, and I said, Anne, let's go out to lunch or something, I want to tell you. And I didn't learn this until, about a year ago. And I actually think it was because of Debbie, as she was talking to my sister. My sister got off the phone, and she has three children, two of my nieces and a nephew. She got off the phone and said, well, Jim wants to have lunch tomorrow, and just me, and he wants to tell me something. And her kids immediately said, what, that he's gay? So my family was fantastic. From day one of me accepting who I am and sharing that with people, they were supportive and loving.
You described meeting your husband, John Arthur. This was at a club, I guess, in Ohio. Love at third sight, not love at first sight.
Correct.
Why did it take three sightings?
Well, the first time we met because of a mutual friend. A friend of mine from university and a friend and fraternity brother of John's at university. We all went to the same university, University of Cincinnati, at the same time. But John and I never met, even though we had a lot of friends in common. So I went out with my friend Kevin, and we went to a bar near that campus. And it wasn't a gay bar. It was just a campus bar. And John happened to be there. So I was with Kevin and other friends. John was with friends or on his own. I can't remember. But Kevin introduced us. And it was just, hi, nice to meet you. One group of friends meeting another. A couple months later, by that point, I'd come out. And we went back to that same bar. And guess who was there at the bar again? John. So we met a second time.
And no fireworks?
Well, evidently there was a little bit. I won't say necessarily fireworks, but John at one point, we were talking about dating, or I can't remember exactly what it was. And John made this comment along the lines of, well, you'd never go out with someone like me. And I still don't know how this came out of my mouth because it wasn't like me. And I immediately responded, well, how do you know? You've never asked. Huh? But still nothing happened. I was back in Cincinnati. I was in graduate school at that point. I was back for the holidays. And at this point, Kevin was one of John's housemates. And John was throwing a New Year's Eve party. And Kevin invited me to that party. So I went to the party. And I never left.
The way Debbie writes about your relationship, I mean, it seems as if the more than 20 years that you were together, you were in many ways just inseparable. You worked together. Everything was about being together.
Absolutely. And everyone in our lives, they never said John without saying and Jim. They never said Jim without saying and John. And you're right, we worked four different jobs with four different companies, sometimes doing the same exact job, sometimes doing that within arm's reach of each other. Our lives were very much all about the two of us.
Debbie, let me turn to you and put this story into some kind of a context. So we're talking about Jim and John in Ohio, and certainly over the last, 15 years or so, a number of states have legalized same-sex marriage, but obviously not all, and certainly not Ohio. Was Ohio, like most other states at the time, basically just for their own legal and perhaps historic reasons, not wanting to recognize same-sex marriage?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And in fact, Ohio embedded in the state's constitution a ban on same-sex marriage. So it is a conservative state. And on top of that, John and Jim were living in Cincinnati, which was known for the longest time as one of the most anti-gay cities in the country. And that was because the voters of Cincinnati in the early 1990s decided that the city could pass no laws that would protect the gay community from any kind of discrimination. Discrimination in employment, discrimination in housing. And so it was considered, in fact, it was called, you know, the city or the town without pity. And that's the city that John and Jim met in and fell in love in. And that was the environment they were living in.
Did you have to sort of pretend that you were not a couple, Jim?
No, I will say never once in our almost 21 years together did we ever pretend that we were not a couple. In fact, every single one of those jobs, every person we worked with, every employer, every client knew we were a couple. We never hid. And we surrounded ourselves with family and friends who loved us, respected us, and considered us a couple, a married couple, even though we weren't. So were we in an unfriendly environment? Absolutely. I can remember no specific instances of discrimination or hatred being directed towards either one of us.
Out in public, walking the street?
Out in public, walking the street. But I also have to say, John wasn't someone to show public affection. So, and also Cincinnati, at that point, you did not want to walk down the street holding hands. You did not want to show public affection. But that was also just John's personality anyway. So we never hid. We weren't the direct recipients of any hatred or discrimination, but we certainly felt it from the community in general.
John and Jim had a beautiful circle of friends and family, completely supportive, and they were very lucky that way. But in fact, in Cincinnati in the early 1990s, two men were arrested. It was a high-profile case because they were holding hands in a parked car. So there were incidents like that throughout the 90s in Cincinnati. And in fact, there were a lot of conservative groups that found a home in Cincinnati. And at first they were anti-pornography, but over time it became anti-gay. So Cincinnati really was a hotbed for discrimination against the gay community.
About a minute before our first break here, Jim, why did you decide to marry your partner, John Arthur?
Because for once we could say, I do. We could make our promises and commitments public and legal and have the federal government acknowledge us and say we exist. We wanted that recognition. We wanted to exist in the eyes of our government.
And we should say at the time he had ALS, which is, as you describe, you know, a cruel disease where you begin to lose just your ability to walk. But you also write that you do feel pain when you have ALS. So he was in excruciating pain.
He did feel pain. And you're right. ALS is just one of the most horrific diseases out there. I mean, to lose every ability to move your hands, move your feet, and eventually you lose the ability to breathe because it paralyzes your diaphragm.
You married him knowing that he was dying.
Absolutely. It was my way to make sure that I could love, honor, and protect him.
They married only a few months before John died, after nearly 21 years together.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with our guests. Jim Obergefell and Debbie Sensipar have co-authored a book called Love Wins, subtitled The Lovers and Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. And this was the case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided just about a year ago, Obergefell v. Hodges. Join our conversation, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the story of the landmark case, Obergefell v. Hodges, a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court just about a year ago affirming the constitutional right of gay couples to marry. Jim Obergefell had married his longtime partner, John Arthur, who was dying from ALS. And when Ohio refused to acknowledge their out-of-state marriage and refused Obergefell's name on the death certificate, they went to court, and that started this lawsuit that led to this decision. And again, the book is called Love Wins. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You describe your marriage. You went to Maryland to get married.
Correct.
You were married on the tarmac of an airport. John was very, very sick at that time.
Correct. He had been diagnosed with ALS in June of 2011, and by the time June 2013 rolled around and the Windsor decision was announced on June 26, 2013, I just immediately leaned over, hugged him and kissed him and said, let's get married. And then we had to figure out how to do it and how to make it happen. And we did. And as you say, we chartered a medical jet, we flew to BWI, landed on the tarmac, and with us in that airplane was John's Aunt Paulette, Aunt Tootie, as we call her. And she had decided years previously that she wanted to be the one to marry us if it could ever happen. And she married us in that airplane. And John was completely bedridden. He was able to move his right hand a little bit. He could speak a few words at a time, and he could move his head. But that was the limit of his ability because of ALS. But we needed to be able to say, I do, I thee wed, and make our promises public and legal.
You even say the ring on his finger was painful for him.
It was. The ring was painful on his finger. Clothing was painful. Being in that medical jet strapped to a thin metal pole gurney was incredibly painful for him. And he had every right to say, Jim, I can't go through this type of pain. This is just too much. But he wanted to do it. Hmm. And he felt like he needed to do it as his way to make his promises to me mean something. And also as a thank you. Because from the moment he was diagnosed, he apologized over and over. He felt like he had ruined my life by getting sick.
That's pretty powerful.
It is.
I mean, it says a lot about him and a lot about you as well. Debbie, Jim mentioned the Windsor decision. This was, again, another very important Supreme Court decision, predated the one that has Jim's name on it. Why was that important?
It was a landmark decision in 2013. What the Supreme Court did is they struck down a key portion of what's known as the Defense of Marriage Act, which was enacted when Clinton was president. And it paved the way for the federal government to begin recognizing state-sanctioned marriages among gay couples, which meant that married gay couples were now eligible for all the federal government benefits that come with marriage. And so for John and Jim, that was the first time the federal government actually recognized same-sex marriage. It expanded the definition of marriage. And so I think Jim would tell you that that's why he proposed to John in that moment, because it was a huge milestone.
You're nodding your head, Jim.
You know, John and I had talked about marriage many times over our almost 21 years together. Family members and friends would ask, do you want to get married? Would you ever do it? And our response was always, yes, we do. However, we want that marriage to be more than symbolic. We want it to carry legal weight. And that's why we never did. And when the Windsor decision came down and that gave us that opportunity to gain legal recognition, we couldn't pass up the opportunity, no matter John's health.
One of the things you write in this book, and Debbie, I'll go back to you, which is Ohio at that point did not recognize gay marriages that were conducted in other states, but they did recognize cousin marriages in other states. They did recognize minors who married in other states. Can you expand on that?
Yeah.
I was frankly surprised to read that.
And that was actually part of the brilliant legal strategy used by Al Gerhardstein, the attorney, civil rights attorney in Cincinnati, who represented John and Jim and helped bring this case to the Supreme Court. There was a legal principle in Ohio that said, you know, wherever the contract was made, they would recognize it. So first cousins who married in other states, even though it was illegal in Ohio, would be recognized in Ohio. Just like you said, underage couples married elsewhere would be recognized. The marriage could cross state lines and be recognized, but completely different for gay couples in Ohio. It was just this weird nuance in the law that they used to help build the first parts of this case.
Talk to us about this. A lawyer, Al Gerhardstein. I mean, seems like quite a character.
I think he is among the most compelling characters in the book. And, you know, I've met a lot of slick lawyers in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Al Gerhardstein is the exact opposite. He is a true believer. And he has spent 35 years fighting for civil rights, fighting for the rights of women, children, fighting for the rights of inmates who were treated, you know, harshly in prisons, and fighting for the rights of the gay community. It started because he has a younger brother who was gay. And in the 80s, his younger brother's partner was fired from a Catholic high school for being gay. And Al took on the Catholic Church. And he had been fighting ever since. I mean, most of the time working without pay to do it. Yeah. And he just believed in John and Jim and believed that the denial of an accurate death certificate for a dying man in Cincinnati was a constitutional violation, no matter what the voters of Ohio said in terms of banning the recognition of marriage.
Do you think he saw this as a second chance since he wasn't able to help his brother? Perhaps he could help John and Jim?
I absolutely agree. Not only was he not able to help his brother, but as I said earlier, the voters of Cincinnati in the early 90s passed this law that said you couldn't protect the gay community with any form of anti-discrimination legislation. That was something that Al fought for 5 years on his own in private practice without pay. Took the case all the way to the Supreme Court. It made national news. He lost. And it killed him. He almost left the law. I mean, he just stopped believing in law. And not law, but the courts and the idea of precedent and other things. And so when this case came along, I think it was a little bit like redemption for him. You know, it was a second chance.
How did you see your lawyer? What was it like to work with him?
When he knocked on our door 5 days after we got married, and we had no plans to do this. We had no thought, no plan, no idea about filing a lawsuit. We simply wanted to get married. And it was because of friends running into Al at a party and sharing our story that we were connected. So he asked if we'd be willing to meet, and we said sure. He came over 5 days after we got married, and when he knocked on the door, in walked this man who immediately made me feel at ease. He is amazingly intelligent, and that's clear from any conversation you have with him. He's kind, he's humble, he's thoughtful. And for me and John and for every other plaintiff, because he had a second case that joined ours, the birth certificate case for Kelly and Kelly, Pam and Nicole, Joe and Rob, and their children, he always kept us front and center as the most important thing and the reason he was doing everything he was doing. I honestly think if a different lawyer, someone else had knocked on the door and come in, if it hadn't been Al, if it hadn't been this man with this aura of goodness and brains, I'm not sure what our reaction would have been. So I credit him.
It's so interesting because there's something serendipitous about that, right? I mean, someone meets at a party, they hear about this story, and then lo and behold, here's a civil rights lawyer ready to roll up his sleeves.
Isn't that always the way these things work out, right? Ordinary people meet and they do extraordinary things. But what Al was doing is he wasn't really setting out to change the world in the beginning. He was setting out to fix this one situation. He wanted a dying man to have an accurate birth certificate, and he wanted Jim to be recognized, rightfully so, as John's spouse. And over time, he added more plaintiffs, and the case expanded, and it became what it was.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Debbie Sinzipper, also with us, Jim Obergefell, talking about their new book they've co-authored called Love Wins. And it's subtitled The Lovers and the Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. That landmark case, Obergefell v. Hodges, decided just about a year ago, and it did affirm the constitutional right of gay couples to marry. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I mean, it is interesting, Jim, to think that you were fighting so hard to get your name on your husband's birth certificate. I mean, just that sort of simple and sad act in many ways, because he was dying.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I know people from the moment we filed suit, people would ask this, and I know people across the country thought this. Well, why did you get married then? You knew Ohio had the state constitutional amendment. What did you expect would happen? And all I can say is that was an abstract concept. We knew that existed. But until you're in that situation and until you come up against something that can be this small and yet this enormous in so many ways, you don't understand the impact of that law. And that's what it was for us. To be told John's last official record as a person would be wrong was heartbreaking, and it was simply wrong. So we had to fight. We had no other option.
Debbie, this book is about a number of players in this case, a federal judge, Tim Black. There's a Judge Martha Daugherty and an Ohio Assistant Attorney General, Bridget Coons, who sort of argued against the lawyer but had her own personal feelings about.
And was very honest about them after the fact. I mean, she represented the Attorney General, Mike DeWine, who is a very familiar name to many people. And Mike DeWine had publicly said he did not support same-sex marriage or the recognition of same-sex marriage. Bridget Kuntz is the Assistant Attorney General of Ohio, who was selected to defend the state's marriage ban and basically go up against John and Jim and the other plaintiffs that joined this case. She personally believed in same-sex marriage. And she describes feeling, you know, in court, like she wanted to stand up and say Bridget Kuntz on behalf of the wrong side of this courtroom. But she also felt like she had a duty to defend the law and represent her boss, Mike DeWine, and that's what she did. But we were really, you know, grateful that she came forward and talked about her feelings for this book, as well as the two sitting federal judges that you talked about. It's wonderful that sitting federal judges kind of broke protocol to talk to us on the record about how they handled this case.
Jim, you mentioned some of the plaintiffs, and they're the plaintiffs, including a little boy, a four-year-old.
Right.
Graydon.
Graydon and Orion, their moms, Pam and Nicole, they wanted to make sure that they had accurate birth certificates that listed both parents. And we relate a story about how Graydon, I believe it was really sick. And one mom took Graydon to the hospital because they were really worried. Well, when she got there, the hospital wouldn't allow her. They wouldn't give her information. They wouldn't allow her to.
They wouldn't treat her son.
They wouldn't treat her son because she wasn't the mother listed on the birth certificate. And that's unconscionable. So they absolutely belong to be in this fight. They deserve that. Their children deserved an accurate record of who their parents are.
Yeah, go ahead, Debbie.
Well, the brilliance of Al's legal strategy was so brilliant, because beyond the death certificate issue, which was so outrageous, he found parents, same-sex couples from New York and Kentucky, who either had children in Cincinnati or in Ohio or adopted at birth in Ohio. And because Cincinnati didn't recognize their out-of-state marriages, they only would list one parent's name on the birth certificate, which deemed the other a legal stranger. That law basically said to the parents, you choose who you want on your birth certificate. The other one, you're off. That has huge implications for children not to have an accurate birth certificate. And so he took that case to court, also in front of Judge Black, and ultimately Ohio's same-sex recognition marriage ban was struck down.
And I've always felt, and I think Justice Kennedy said this in several different of his opinions, about once you had gay couples who could adopt children, then, you know, you put the issue of children's rights, children's protections. I'm looking at you, Debbie.
Well, think about what a birth certificate is. I mean, you need one to travel out of the country with your children, to enroll your child in college or school, to take your child out of school if you need to get hospital care for your child. And if you are the parent who was unlucky enough not to have your name on your child's birth certificate, in the eyes of your state, you're not considered their parent. And to me, as an outsider looking in, into this, that was just outrageous. It was just punitive.
Well, Jim. And I also look at it from the perspective of, you have these two parents. One is listed on the birth certificate of their child or their children. Well, what if the parent who is listed on that birth certificate dies? The states would argue, we are doing these things in the interest of the children. We care about the children. I'm sorry, but if you care about the children, the last thing you could possibly want to do or force to happen is to put a child or children at risk of being torn from the only remaining parent they have ever known. That is not caring for children. That is not family friendly. That is simply wrong.
Were you surprised the U.S. Supreme Court decided to take this case as you were making your way through the courts?
I don't think so. Can I say definitively yes or no? No, I wasn't surprised. And the reason I wasn't, when we lost at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, the six cases from Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Michigan, that was the very first appeals court decision and federal decision that had come out against marriage equality for quite some time. And that created that conflict between appeals courts, and that, to me, was the silver lining that now the Supreme Court really should take up this issue. And that was what gave me hope. When we lost at the Sixth Circuit, it was a very painful decision. Really, I will admit, I found it offensive. But the silver lining was, maybe now the Supreme Court will step in and decide this once and for all. And they did.
And it wasn't the original attorney, Debbie, who argued the case. And this, obviously, a painful decision, but perhaps the right one.
I don't know if it was the right one, but it certainly was ultimately successful. So Al Gerhardstein had waited his whole life to argue before the Supreme Court. The first time he went to the Supreme Court, he didn't argue. The Supreme Court ruled before Al had a chance to argue. So this was a career-making thing, and these were his plaintiffs. And he has pictures of the kids and the plaintiffs in his office. I mean, this meant everything to him. But ultimately, there were lawyers from four states involved in this big consolidated case, and there are lawyers who specialize at arguing before the Supreme Court. They're known oralists, and Al stepped aside on behalf of his – for the good of the case, because there was a more experienced oralist who wanted to do it.
Tells you something about the man, does it not, Jim?
It says so much about the character of Al Gerhardstein.
And the plaintiffs, Jim and others, stood up and defended him when this decision was made. You know, please give it to Al. He deserves it. It's the right thing to do. And Al stepped aside anyway, and it was heartbreaking for him. But ultimately, he wanted to win this case.
He kept us first and foremost, and he did what he believed was best for us, the plaintiffs.
Which was to give this case that he cared so deeply about over to some other, perhaps more experienced...
A Washington, D.C. lawyer who had argued before the Supreme Court many times and actually argued beautifully during oral arguments here. I mean, he's a great oralist, but Al felt it in his gut and the plaintiffs and in his heart, and the plaintiffs knew that.
It's the man he is.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about how a case was decided about just about a year ago, a now landmark case, Obergefell v. Hodges, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision, affirming the constitutional right of gay couples to marry, a landmark case, a historic case, and talking with Jim Obergefell, the lead plaintiff in this case, and also with Debbie Sinzipper. They have co-authored a book called Love Wins, The Lovers and Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. I should add that Debbie Sinzipper, winner of a Pulitzer Prize, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY to join the conversation. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we are talking about how the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision about a year ago, Obergefell v. Hodges, a decision giving gay couples the constitutional right to get married. And again, that's what our guests cover in their book called Love Wins, Debbie Sinzipper and Jim Obergefell, the lead plaintiff in this case. Jim, how did you get to be the lead plaintiff?
Nothing more complicated than timing. The Supreme Court tradition is when there's a consolidated case, they name that consolidated case based on the lowest case number. So our case was the lowest case number.
And does anyone ever say your name correctly?
Sometimes.
Including me?
It happens, but, you know, I don't worry about that. That's not important. And honestly, it makes me chuckle thinking about all of the law students going forward who will struggle with Obergefell.
Obergefell, exactly. What were the reasons, Debbie, that the court wanted to take this? I mean, what were they looking to investigate or decide on?
Well, as Jim said, there was a split among the circuit courts of appeals in this country. And when there is a split, the Supreme Court considers it, usually steps in because there was a significant question of federal importance that they wanted to resolve once and for all. And it was actually good timing. You know, this issue has been out there for so many years. And by the time the case went to the Supreme Court, a majority of Americans, based on all reputable polls by CNN, The Washington Post, and others, supported marriage equality. They supported same-sex couples. So it was kind of a perfect storm because there was a split in the circuit courts. There was a significant federal question to address. And for the lawyers representing 30-some plaintiffs in four states, it was a perfect thing.
And the arguments went on for, what, something like 2.5 hours, which I think is pretty unusual for the U.S. Supreme Court. I thought they sort of kept it to an hour and...
Well, there were two questions to address.
Yes.
And that's why it went on, you might consider it to be longer.
Okay.
The first question was, should same-sex marriage be legal? Should we expand the definition of marriage in four states like Ohio, who had a ban in their constitution, to legalize same-sex marriage? The second question was, if we don't legalize same-sex marriages, should states like Ohio at least have to recognize marriages performed in other states? When the court ruled in favor of the first issue, second issue didn't matter anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what they did. What was it like to watch this case being argued, Jim?
It was scary. It was somewhat fun, but I found that in that moment, in those oral arguments, I needed to keep my brain kind of quiet. So I concentrated on just taking notes on what was said, the questions that were asked, the rebuttals that came up. I tried not to think about it a whole lot, and that kept my brain just from going crazy. And for me, there are two moments that stand out in the oral arguments. One happened before they started, and Aunt Tootie and I were in the courtroom in public seats, and we were seated with other people who had no idea who I was. Aunt Tootie let it slip who I was, and the reaction of the people around me was fantastic. And one really important to me personally, I will never forget this. The gentleman sitting next to me said, "Jim, I have to tell you, your and John's story has really touched someone. I have a twin brother who's a Roman Catholic priest, and he called me this morning because he knew I was coming. And he said, 'Rob, I have to tell you, I read about them, and their story just really had an impact on me, really touched me.'" A few moments later, Rob is talking to Tootie, Aunt Tootie, and says, "John and Jim's story really touched two people." And I thought, well, who's the second person you told me about your brother? And then he turned to me, shook my hand, and said, "I'm an evangelical Republican," and he thanked me. And that was the moment when it really became real to me that our story resonated with people. Stories can change hearts and minds, and love is love, and love does win. The other thing that I remember, the last couple moments of the entire 2.5-hour session of oral arguments, was when Douglas Hallward Dreimeyer, who argued for the right to recognition,
right,
when he brought it back, and I've said this over and over, they kept the plaintiffs front and center. He brought it back, and his last few sentences were about John and me. He brought the story, the arguments, back down to the personal level, the people at the heart of it. And to me, it was such a wonderful thing to hear our story, our names mentioned, and I felt like we had the last word.
Hmm. Were you there?
I was outside for oral arguments. I was there for decision day inside the Supreme Court. But oral arguments outside was, this is, according to all legal scholars, the biggest civil rights case in years, really as big as Roe v. Wade or Brown versus Board of Education, which desegregated the nation's schools. And the line just to get in was wrapped around the corner of the Supreme Court. People had camped out for days to get tickets to go inside. It was just electric.
Was Westboro Baptist Church there?
I think they were.
I'm pretty sure they were.
People on the other side of
many,
this
many
issue.
People. But there were also rainbow flags and school children and the gay men's chorus singing the Star Spangled Banner. It really was beautiful. In fact, I took my own children because I wanted them to witness history.
Well, and it was Justice Kennedy that wrote the decision and talked about the transcendence of marriage. I mean, he used really lofty language. Can you expand on that, Debbie?
He used beautiful language. And his opinion was, of course, read around the world. I mean, what was that beautiful line about marriage brings together, I don't remember.
I think I have it.
You know what I'm talking
about? I do. Through the enduring bond, two persons together can find other freedoms such as expression, intimacy, and spirituality. This is true for all persons, whatever their sexual orientation. There is dignity in the bond between two men and two women who seek to marry, and their autonomy to make such profound choices.
Yeah.
That's Justice Kennedy.
Yeah, it was a beautiful opinion. In fact, there was a line that we wanted to use to make the title of our book, but it was just a little bit too long, so the publisher went with Love Wins.
Oh, what was the line?
It was something that I think you
something
read.
In there.
Yeah, and it was just so eloquent and so beautiful. It was just when he read it out loud in the courtroom, I mean, just nobody was breathing. It was just unbelievable.
What were the arguments on the other side for the four justices that did not sign on to this opinion?
Mostly that, you know, this is a decision that should be left up to the states. And that's a common, well-known legal argument. Constitutional scholars debate it all the time. State rights, let's leave it up to the people and legislatures, and wouldn't it be better to change hearts and minds by working through voters than having the Supreme Court hand down a decision? And the argument on the other side is, yes, but, you know, the will of voters doesn't trump the Constitution and the rights of the gay community to be able to marry. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that was the argument that won.
I always go back to what Al said in our very first hearing when that concept came up, Al Gerhardstein, and the state said, you know, the majority voted, and the people have spoken, why should we overturn that? And Al's response, and I will paraphrase, the surest way to abridge the rights of a minority is to allow the majority to vote on them. And to me, that is the role, that is a primary role of our court system.
Let me get some callers in. We have Dr. Kinney from Kutztown joining us. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Good morning. I have chills up and down my spine right now. My own work is in the area of interracial marriage, and as we know, Sunday was the 49th anniversary of the Supreme Court's historic Loving decision, and Mildred Loving, just before she died, was heard to have said that she very much supported and hoped that the same thing that happened for interracial marriage would eventually happen for gay marriage. And so I wonder what part of the Loving decision impacted, if any, was taken into consideration in terms of this historic decision.
Yeah, it's a great question. Go ahead.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's a great question. And in fact, there is a scene in the book that specifically talks about the Loving decision and its importance. Because one of the lawyers from Kentucky who represented same-sex couples is an African-American woman married to a white man. And she says in the book, you know, if it weren't for Loving, this marriage would never have happened. And she felt like when she then took on the civil rights case involving gay couples, she was actually paying it forward. Huh. And she said because of Loving, her marriage was made legal. And now she wanted to do the same thing for gay couples. And it's one of the most compelling, I think, scenes in the book.
Yeah, Jen, did you want to add to that?
Well, and just, I know, can I tell you the extent to which it was used? No, but I can absolutely tell you it was one of the main arguments, one of the main cases cited in every step of the way in support of our right to marry. So it was very important.
How soon, once I guess, was it Kennedy who read the decision?
It was.
At what point did you realize that the court had ruled in your favor? Because sometimes with these legal opinions, they go on and you kind of wait for that whatever, and sometimes it's hard to know if it's there or not.
I don't know how long it took me, but when he started to read the decision, my initial thought was, we won. And he kept reading, and I thought, well, I think so. He kept reading, and we won. Followed shortly thereafter with, I maybe? And then it sunk in, and it truly became clear that we won. So it was several sentences into his decision before it hit me, and I burst into tears.
And so did the other lawyers in the room, even hardened Supreme Court lawyers.
Really?
Were up in the lawyer section crying. Al was crying and all the other lawyers were crying. And you could hear tears throughout the courtroom.
So as we've been talking about this, but what makes this such a landmark case, Debbie?
Well, it is the biggest decision in the history of gay rights to date. I'm sure there will be more after this, but it is by far the biggest decision. It expanded the definition of marriage to include gay couples. And that, you know, it's legal scholars, as I said, say it's the biggest decision in generations.
Did you cry?
I'm supposed to be a hardened journalist, but I've cried many times throughout this whole this.
Really?
I was in there for decision day. I was sitting next to a young gay man, and he was so tense. I remember putting my hand on his knees saying, relax, take a deep breath, relax. And I cried different times writing this book, because not just about John and Jim, but about the parents who fought so hard to protect their children. I mean, that just really moved me and inspired me. I just couldn't believe what they had to go through to protect their families.
And I'm sure for you, Jim, it was bittersweet knowing that you had won, but Jim had died. You had lost your husband.
Absolutely bittersweet. You know, in that moment, all I wanted to do was hug John, kiss him, and say, baby, we won. We matter. Mm. And I couldn't do it. But what I could do is join the celebration, and I could enjoy that beautiful feeling of the first time in my open adult gay life of feeling like I was actually part of We the People.
Ah, you really felt that at
I
that
did.
Moment.
Absolutely.
You know, we're having this discussion just a couple of days after the horrifying mass shooting in Orlando, Florida at a gay club. 49 people killed, some continuing to be seriously injured. And, you know, it does raise just the specter, I guess, of it's hard to know what the shooter was thinking, but the specter of homophobia. And I'm just wondering, Jim, what your thoughts are this week.
Well, my thoughts, I mean, like any thinking, feeling American person, human being, I was devastated, heartbroken, and just this amazing amount of anguish to hear the news. And all I can think and all I can hope is that this horrible hate crime, this atrocious act, will cause people to stop and think about what they say, how they act, and how they treat their fellow human beings. Because regardless of who pulled that trigger, regardless of anything about that person, there are too many voices in our country that have contributed to the problem. They demean the LGBTQ community. They call us evil. They call us wrong. They call us outside of society, outside of humanity. They have helped create an environment where things like this can happen. And I hope this causes soul-searching and deep reflection. And I will say the thing for me that I am really thankful about is to be out here right now, this week, after this happened, and to be talking about this book and the message of this book, Love Wins. It has been healing for me, and I know it has been healing for the people that I have talked to about, that Debbie and I have talked to about this book. And to be surrounded on our launch day by members of the LGBTQ community and allies at the LGBTQ Center in New York the day after this horrible thing was the best thing possible for me, and I've heard from others it was what they needed. Love does win, and we have to remember that.
Do you want to weigh in on this at all? I mean, there certainly has been on the other side, and I hear what Jim is saying, on the other side, just also this strong support of the gay community as well.
I think clearly the American public supports the gay community. They supported marriage equality. I mean, there is so much love and support for the gay community. But what Sunday shows us, what happened on Sunday, is that there are still haters out there. There are haters in the public, and some say there are haters in public office. And, you know, we need to figure out why that is. Mm-hmm. You know, as a journalist, I see so many problems in the world and in our backyards. And why are we so against the gay community? It doesn't make any sense. What I learned in a year of writing this book is these are loving, committed couples who only want to build families and be part of the world and productive citizens. So I don't understand the hate.
The president's going to be, I believe, in Orlando today, speaking, I think, to what happened on Monday. Are there things, Jim, you hope the president says?
No, because he has always said things better than I could say. He has always come out in support of us. He is the best friend of the LGBTQ community we could have in the White House. So I don't have to ask him to say anything. I don't have to wonder or worry about what he's going to say, because I know it will be the appropriate thing, and it will be nothing but support to help our country heal and to help our country move forward.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Jim Obergefell, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Marty.
And Debbie Sensipar, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is called Love Wins, The Lovers and Lawyers Who Fought the Landmark Case for Marriage Equality. And our guests are going to be across the street at the National Constitution Center at 6:30 tonight, talking more about this case and this book. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.